It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out about the days in Wisconsin when butter was king.
First, we're learning about new legislation that Assembly Republicans unveiled today. This proposal would sharply roll back Wisconsin's prevailing wage law, but wouldn't fully repeal the law as part of a compromise among Republican lawmakers.
Jason Stein is with us to explain. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So how does Wisconsin's current prevailing wage law work? Where does it stand?
Okay, it actually works by being several prevailing wage laws. There are different statutes on the books that set kind of a salary floor for workers on public works type construction projects. And so there's one law for state projects in general, one for state highways, and then another one for local government construction projects like schools and cities and such.
So why would you say prevailing wage is such a point of controversy in the current budget talks in the Wisconsin legislature?
You know, it's like anything in life. It involves money, and that always gets people tense. In this case, what the law is doing is it's saying you, the government, which is to say taxpayers and citizens, need to pay a minimum salary, which is set using a complex formula for, you know, different types of workers on public projects. You know, unions, some construction firms like that because it provides good wages for the workers on those projects and can help ensure a supply of workers that are ready to do them. But at the same time, other people, you know, groups that may represent taxpayers or conservatives say, look, we're artificially inflating the price tag of these projects by requiring a minimum salary.
Do we know what kind of an economic impact having prevailing wage laws in place have on Wisconsin's economy?
Sure. It is difficult to quantify that, and I mean it's not purely a cop out on my part to say that. I mean, part of the reason it's difficult to quantify is that the federal government, they've got their own sets of laws. So, for instance, we could repeal at the state level our law that deals with state highway projects, but then you've still got this federal law that kicks in whenever federal money is involved. And I mean, obviously, guess what? The federal money comes in the big projects that really account for a big chunk of our transportation budget. So there's that factor. And then, you know, there's also the factor of, you know, some of these costs can be sort of baked into projects, so they can be difficult to sort of untangle from the cost of the whole project. It basically comes down to opponents of the laws say that they really substantially increase the cost of projects. Supporters say that when you account for having good quality workmanship and other things, that there's not a lot of substantial savings for taxpayers in the long run. So there is a dispute over that.
Earlier today, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss proposed changing the prevailing wage law. How would he like to see a change?
So he would like to see substantial overhaul of the law that stops short of a total repeal. Conservatives in the legislature and outside the legislature would like to see the law repealed entirely, or at least repealed for all local governments, so that the towns, schools, villages, cities, you name it. Voss is proposing something that stops, you know, well short of that. It would eliminate the law for technical college projects and, you know, some others. It would raise the cost threshold for when the law kicks in. So, you know, it would be many times higher than what it is now. For, you know, there's several different levels now where it kicks in, depending on the project. It would just go to $450,000 or more. And then, you know, there's a host of other changes that he wants to make that we can get into if you want to get into those.
Jason Stein is with us. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We are talking about proposed changes to the prevailing wage laws in Wisconsin. And Jason, so you said that part of it is to raise the cost threshold for when prevailing wage is triggered. So if it's under that threshold, there are no controls on what the wages are that are being paid?
Right. I mean, that if it's below, and this is true now, that, for instance, if you have a $48,000 or less state project that involves just a single trade or a single type of worker, anything less than that, a $40,000 project, the prevailing wage law would not kick in. And, you know, now I think, you know, under this proposal, that would be set at $450,000. So you'd have a lot more projects that would potentially fall under that exemption.
That seems like a huge increase.
It does. I mean, what Voss says is that it would now 60% of the projects would be covered. But I think, you know, it bears in mind, too, that, you know, if you build a single $100 million, you know, or even one, you know, $500 million highway interchange, you know, that's going to cover a lot of air conditioning repairs at local school districts. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So even though you're raising it by such a large amount, I have not seen, and I think anyone would need to see kind of an analysis of what that does to the total dollar size of projects that are being affected before you can really say, oh, okay, that just totally wipes it out, or you know, like what, before you start jumping to assumptions about, well, what would be the impact of this change in the real world.
Another change that Speaker Voss is proposing is exempting prevailing wage information from the state's open records law. That doesn't seem like it's a financial decision. It seems like there's another motivation there. How much would that change things?
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, that's a noteworthy part of the proposal. You know, there would still be some information that would be available under the open records law. So at this point, we still need to get more in the weeds about what would and wouldn't be open to the public. What the Republicans' goal here is clearly to limit the ability of unions to raise challenges about whether contractors are following the law. So I gather, you know, and Speaker Voss said this, that some of that information and those requests have been used in the past to aid in challenges to, you know, whether contractors are following the law. And there are several other changes in the bill that will probably make it a little bit more difficult for unions to do that sort of thing.
So Representative Voss's proposal doesn't fully repeal the prevailing wage law, which is what quite a few Republicans have been asking for and advocating for. Democrats want to see it strengthened, certainly not done away with and not weakened. Does he really have a lot of people that are going to line up behind him on this proposal?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you know, clearly there were not a lot of people outside of Assembly Republicans who were jumping out to praise this proposal today. You know, for instance, there's a group of local government groups and contractors that also came out today and said, you know, we appreciate Voss doing this because we'd like to see changes to this law, but we'd still rather have an exemption of all local governments. So, you know, there really wasn't a wave of support for this proposal come out today. At the same time, I think it's pretty clear that Republicans are going to pass something some changes to the prevailing wage. And, you know, at the moment, there's not a competing proposal out there. And I think that was part of the point of what the speaker did, was he was trying to emphasize the fact that in his house, his party has a plan for making changes to this. And in the Senate, where, you know, it, to a certain extent, the state budget is hung up right now, you know, there's I think three different senators who are working on different plans for changing the prevailing wage, but none of those plans has been put on paper and given out to the public.
Jason, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He was with us today to talk about the new proposal on prevailing wage that Assembly Republicans unveiled today. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin was the last state to overturn its ban on yellow margarine. The law was intended to shield Wisconsin citizens from the dangers of butter fakes, causing otherwise law-abiding citizens to cross state lines for the cheaper yellow margarine. Dan Perkins recalls the smuggling operations from a Spooner childhood.
Imagine this. It is 1950. Spooner, a Friday evening. Darkness is descending. My mother and a few of her friends are sitting around the kitchen table talking quietly. One woman says, "Who will drive?" Another says, "Not me. I drove last week." A third chimes in, "I'll go this time, but I want gas money before I leave." We children would be playing around the house, but when we entered the kitchen, the conversation would stop or change to a different subject. We could tell something special was happening. Only later did we learn that they weren't talking about rum running or dope peddling. Rather, they were working out the details of the weekly run across the border to Pine City, Minnesota, to avoid the state tax and purchase uncolored oleomargarine. That we lived across the street from a state senator made the planning more exciting. For many years, Wisconsin taxed uncolored oleo, and that law was not changed until 1967. I guess the legislators thought people would confuse colored oleo with butter. One state law required restaurants and hotels serving oleo to post signs to that effect. But in 1950, uncolored oleo was available and at a good price in Minnesota. So to avoid the added tax, people from a number of Wisconsin communities made runs to Minnesota to purchase cases of the illegal spread. These oleo runs were against the law, and the runner might be caught by the police. No one ever said how the police might know if someone had uncolored oleo in their car, but just knowing their actions were illegal was cause for caution. But the runner went, often alone and on back roads. The driver's return, with a trunk full of uncolored oleo, always took place after we were in bed. There was no overt discussion of the smuggling, but there was always a rush to move the product. So often, we kids became part of the process. Uncolored oleo was packaged in a clear plastic bag that contained a small bubble, which, when broken, allowed a dye into the package. We would massage the package to make the oleo a pinkish color. Now, having some color, if seen by someone, it would not stand out as the uncolored, untaxed version. Still cautious, my mother would then say, "Take this bag over to Mrs. X's house and do not go past the senator's house." Or, "Put these boxes in the basement until Mr. Y stops by to get them." This was rather exciting. What would happen if the senator did see us? Maybe just say hello, or, "How are your parents?" What would we do? Still, we kids could tell that even after the distribution phase, these lawbreakers did not feel safe. There were comments, softly spoken between my parents, about Mrs. So-and-so's trip to Minnesota, or about whether they should even do it again. To this day, not being fully aware of the statute of limitations on such nefarious criminal acts in this state, I suspect you will find few who will admit to their involvement. What I do know is that my family who was there, brother, sister, cousin, still smiles and laughs about our part in the Wisconsin oleo caper.
Dan Perkins is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Communication at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
And joining us now to tell us more about the history of the Margarine Wars is Marilee Lee, Director of the Hoard Historical Museum in Fort Atkinson. Marilee, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So give us the background. What circumstances set up this battle and such really stringent legislation about butter and margarine?
Certainly. And really to understand this, we need to go back a little bit and understand the history of oleomargarine. Oleomargarine was developed in about 1869 by a French scientist. And it is a combination of beef fat and other fatty acids, and it really is a man-made creation. And our dairy farmers and dairy farmers throughout the U.S. saw it as a major concern that people could manufacture a spread that, when colored, tasted and resembled butter and had a longer shelf life and, you know, at various points was seen as healthier than butter. And it really started to undercut the dairy market, and particularly the butter manufacturing. And really throughout the late 19th century, starting about 1887, then 1889, or 1895, excuse me, there were moves to create legislation to ban either at least the use or manufacture or the coloring of margarine. Margarine, when it's not colored, really looks more like lard. It's that kind of off-white, pearly color. And it's not always appetizing, especially if you're expecting to be able to smear something that looks like butter on your bread. So by limiting the coloring of it, it was hopeful that it would help limit the sale of it. I'm the director of the Hoard Historical Museum, and it's named in honor of a family, the Hoard family here in Fort Atkinson, who was very influential, not only in Fort Atkinson, but really Wisconsin, in bringing dairy to Wisconsin. William Dempster Hoard, who was governor of Wisconsin elected in 1888, was a major proponent of dairy. He started Hoard's Dairyman and Hoard's Farm, and was one of the leading voices who recommended that Wisconsin farmers switch to dairy. So when he saw this concern about oleomargarine coming onto the market, he and many others started working to try and limit it on the market, either the manufacturer or selling of it, of anything of the like. And moving forward a little bit, in 1902, there was a bill called the Grout Bill that was passed by the U.S. Congress that limited margarine being shipped and then from state to state, and then also increased the tax of it as well. So really putting a tariff on it to try and help limit it.
So clearly there was an economic concern for Wisconsin dairy farmers, milk producers, but that's not necessarily a convincing argument to make to the public. Don't buy margarine because we're afraid of
right.
losing money. So I'm sure that there were more creative ways that they tried to make margarine less appealing, besides the fact that it was against the law. But what was kind of the propaganda maybe that was going out against
sure.
margarine?
Sure. Well, you know, the propaganda really then boils down to what it's manufactured from. Caul fat, which is a type of beef fat, and acids. And you, that alone, right there, would be enough as a marketing tool to not want people to use it. You're just spreading fat on your toast, where you could put butter, a wholesome, healthy butter, which comes from the cow. It's meant to be used in this form. There's a great quote from Governor Hoard, who says that every mother on earth, in the animal kingdom, that suckles her young, puts butter fat in her milk for the nourishment and digestion. Now, why is oleomargarine not as wholesome as butter fat? Separate butter fat from milk, introduce oleo fat as a substitute, and feed that to young infants. And that will not be as healthy for the young infants as just having the milk. So it really goes back to this is a man-made substance. It's not found in nature. Do you really want to give that to your children?
So what were the penalties if an individual or, say, a restaurant or a grocery store was found to be in possession of oleo?
Sure. In 1910, a gentleman from Janesville was sentenced to 18 months in federal prison for selling oleomargarine as butter. And even still today, I believe it's still on the books that if a restaurant has to put butter on the table, they can provide margarine if the customer asks for it. But again, in a restaurant and then also students, patients, and inmates of any state institution must have butter as well. And then if anyone violates any of that, they can be fined not less than $100, but no more than $500, or imprisoned for not more than 3 months.
We have just about 30 seconds left, but can you tell us very briefly about the infamous blind taste test in 1965 in the Senate chambers?
Yes, in 1965, like you said, the two leading parties who were trying to repeal part of the bill decided to have a taste test, and they ended up with three samples, one butter, one margarine, and then one of a low-fat dairy spread from the University of Wisconsin. And they had all of the senators go through and taste all of these samples and try and figure out which was butter, which was margarine, and which was the low-fat dairy spread. And most of them did pretty well. About 32 identified the butter as butter. 28 identified the margarine as margarine. And then asked what they liked best. 21 favored the butter over the spread or the margarine.
That's just fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, Marilee, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a little backstory on that amazing part of history.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Marilee Lee is the director of the Hoard Historical Museum in Fort Atkinson. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the Supreme Court wrapped up its current session today with its three final rulings. We'll look at the court's decisions on EPA regulations, redistricting, and lethal injections.
First, the governor's recent budget proposals included the striking of tenure protections for UW professors from state law. While the UW System Board of Regents has pledged to draft similar protections into university policy, our guest isn't convinced they'll be strong enough to protect professors who have dissident voices, like conservatives.
John Sharpless joins us now in studio. He's a history professor at UW-Madison and former Republican congressional candidate. He and fellow professor Donald Downs wrote about tenure for Politico.com. John, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, what was your first take when you first heard the governor's proposed changes to the UW system tenure policy, possibly striking it from state law?
Actually, I didn't know what to do with it. We're the only public university that has tenure recognized in law, and symbolically, that's very important to us. It's part of a tradition in the Wisconsin system. It's nestled into the right of free speech on campus, the right academic freedom. We have that wonderful plaque at the top of the hill, which quotes the sifting and winnowing and the famous Ely case. So it's more tradition. I think the very fact that they have repealed it showed that there was nothing particularly strong about it being in law.
Well, academic freedom and speech are two issues on the table that you're looking at closely. And do you think that these changes will hurt, have the potential to hurt, academic freedom at Wisconsin's public universities?
I'm not sure. The regents have pledged to maintain the policy that was in the statute. They've already voted for that. I trust them that they will, as this current group will, protect freedom of speech and academic freedom on campus. I don't know what happens beyond this group of regents, however. But there's something that I think may be more important here. It may be less a matter of individuals being at risk. They may be. I don't know. I think whole departments and campuses and programs could easily be at risk. What's gone on here is we've essentially given university administrators an enormous power, because not only have they no longer bound by tenure requirements, the legislature also did away with joint governance. That combination means that the people in the administrations of the various campuses can, without consultation, close down departments, programs, and indeed they could close down whole campuses.
Now, are you worried in particular that this is something that leaves conservatives, in particular, vulnerable?
Well, we argued that in the article. We were trying to remind the legislature that there are a few of us on campus. I think they tend to view campuses as bastions of liberalism. And indeed, I'd say the predominant point of view on campus is to the liberal side. But every campus has its share of conservatives. And perhaps it'd be important to point out is that liberalism is defined in a variety of ways, too. It's possible on a campus to get in trouble as a liberal, as was shown at Northwestern, where a feminist scholar was called to task by some students who were troubled by an opinion piece that she wrote for the Chronicles of Higher Education. And she was put through a hearing, which was just appalling. She wasn't allowed a lawyer. She wasn't allowed to know what the charges were. Fortunately, she came through it, but it was a very harrowing experience. In that case, it was a dissident liberal who found themselves at risk.
Now, you said that's what we argued in the piece. Mm-hmm. You didn't say that's what I think right now. Have you changed your thinking since you wrote the piece?
I haven't changed. We mentioned the problem of blanket denial of tenure in the piece, if you'll remember. We talk about programs being closed down. The more I think about it, I think that's a more likely outcome of this. It'd be hard to, I like to think that my opinions are particularly pointed and people really don't want to hear them, and I'm going to get picked on at a moment's notice. I think a lot of us in academia like to think that's true. But it'd be hard to believe that the Regents would close down the history department just to get at me. They may decide to close down history departments across the campuses because they decide that we cannot show definitively that it leads to higher employment in the state of Wisconsin. Remember, much of this comes out of some rhetoric that wants to see our campuses much more finely tuned to the marketplace. So programs that can't document direct employment outcomes may be at risk under the new system.
Well, as a conservative, you tend to be in favor of moves that support fiscal conservatism. Do you see this, striking tenure possibly from state statute, as a move that would, in fact, save money for Wisconsin?
It could. It could well do that. And there's a side of me, I'm sort of divided on this. I do think universities have had a problem, public universities have had a problem in the recent past. They have not shown themselves to be fiscally responsible. Tuition continues to rise. Student indebtedness is appalling in this country. And it might be that universities need to be challenged on their budgets. Now, whether or not that means that blanket layoffs are justified, I remain unconvinced of that. The problem now is that bureaucrats could decide that without any input from students and faculty and alumni. They would just completely gut the university if they decided that a program was not meeting market needs.
Right, and there has been a lot of cultural debate about what universities are for, whether they're for jobs mm-hmm. and helping people enter the marketplace with an advantage, or whether they're sort of something maybe a little more lofty, the search for truth, the sifting and winnowing kind of thing. How do you answer that question? What are universities for?
I've done a lot of thinking about this recently, and I think the current debate is a very good one to think through what universities are about. We've got a very good two-year college system in this state. It's one of the best in the country. Their charge is to directly respond to the marketplace. They turn out welders, they turn out plumbers, they turn out people in the health sciences, technicians. That's their job. They do it well. It's not clear to me that the University of Wisconsin is the best place to have that kind of job-oriented education available. I'm a pretty good barnyard welder. I can weld up a project so it doesn't fall apart. But I'd never want to teach my history students how to weld. I'm there as a history professor. And I do think there's something about a university education, which is about growing up intellectually. Now, we could reject that. You could say those 4 years are really about job placement. It's about fitting some students into the marketplace. But I think it's good to have history. I think it's good to have literature. It is good to have political science, teach physics for poets. so that people understand science in an intuitive way, not necessarily as an engineer would, but in a way that they can read the newspaper or go on the web and understand scientific discussions.
We're talking right now with UW History Professor John Sharpless, talking about proposed changes to tenure at the UW system. And going back to tenure specifically, we were talking a bit about academic freedom. You were concerned about whole departments, whole programs, maybe the doors open to them being eliminated, which is something you're thinking about, you're a little concerned about right now. So if we look at academic freedom, do you think that tenure is synonymous with academic freedom? Do you need tenure to have it?
Yes. I think the history of the organization that we've had at this campus, Don and I and others have had consistently cases over the decades in which somebody has spoken out in a way that challenges the norms on campus. And they've been subject to harassment. They've been subject to the threat of a hearing without cause. It happens just often enough for me to be concerned. And I think in the current environment across the country, it's becoming increasingly difficult for people to say anything about anything. We're in a sensitivity moment. You never know in a classroom if there's somebody who's going to be troubled by an offhand remark, a silly joke that may not be funny, but at least you want the person to understand it's a joke. And they don't even understand it's a joke. And all of a sudden you've offended the student and they have leverage and they'll find a constituency among the faculty. And that's what tenure is all about. It's a set of procedures that protect people. By the way, it doesn't insulate you from being fired for incompetence or unprofessional behavior. I mean, that does happen all the time, all across America. It isn't an insulation from good behavior and professional conduct.
And tenure in general has come under fire from some Republicans who conceptualize it as a job for life, saying that nobody really deserves a job for life, especially in today's dicey economy. What is your take on the institution of tenure from that perspective?
I don't think we deserve a job for life. I think we need... We're called.
Is that even a fair way to frame it? Do you agree with that way of framing it, John?
I don't think anybody deserves a job for life. You've got to show up every day. You've got to do the work. You've got to be you've got to be able to deliver professionally in terms of your education. Absolutely. one of the recent cases, which is just humorous, a professor who at Michigan State who was a little on the senile side took all his clothes off during lecture, and they pressured him to resign. Early retirement is, I think, what it was about. I think that there is an argument to be made that professors are called upon time and again to challenge the frontiers of knowledge, and that may offend people. People in the English department writing fiction that challenges people's ideas, people in the ethnic studies program that force us to think about race and ethnicity in new ways, people in women's studies who ask us to think about gender in new ways and challenge us, people in the biological sciences that may say things that are troubling to various religious constituencies in the state, but they should be able to argue for scientific knowledge based on their professional criteria. We are called upon to make those statements. You need to protect us from people who are offended.
So given that, how do you feel about this proposal to take tenure language out of state statute? It's still a little bit up in the air about what sort of policy will eventually find its way into university policy to replace it. So given that there's a question mark, how do you feel about just striking it from state law?
I'm troubled by it. But mostly symbolically. Overall, I think in the next decade, we're not going to see a substantial change in tenure. What I'm worried about is damaging the brand. The University of Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin system is one of the best in the world. Coca-Cola wouldn't damage the brand like this legislature has. It's damaged the brand fundamentally. when our young people graduate from this university, they've got to be able to go up against students that are from Minnesota and Illinois and Northwestern for jobs and for entrance into law schools. And what has happened over the last 6 months is the nation of scholars and people who will hire them on the job are suspicious about our system. That's what's gone on here. That's what's most important. The brand has been damaged. I don't even know if it can be repaired now.
We're talking to John Sharpless, history professor at UW-Madison and a former Republican congressional candidate.
And we'd like to know what you think. Do you worry that tenure changes proposed in the state budget could leave conservatives on college campuses at risk? Do you think calling tenure a job for life is a fair take on what tenure is? Or do you see it as being about academic freedom? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about our guest case that getting rid of tenure protections in Wisconsin law could leave conservative voices at risk, and he says damage the brand, the Wisconsin University brand. Talking with John Sharpless now. He's a history professor at UW-Madison and a former Republican congressional candidate.
And we want to know what you think. Do you worry that tenure changes proposed in the state budget could leave conservatives and others on college campuses at risk? What do you think about the governor's proposed changes to tenure? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. Jim is joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I agree with that, what the guest is saying. My comment is that, tenure isn't meant, where professors will have a job for life. It is to protect academic freedom. And I'm concerned, well, first thing, I think the Republicans like to use the saying that, tenure is just to protect them for life and a job. It was the same thing they did with the state workers in general when they said they are the haves and the rest of you are the have-nots. It's just a way to whip the general public into a frenzy. But also, like I've seen with the Department of Natural Resources, where now they got rid of scientists and they got rid of educators because they, quote, no longer serve the purpose of the agency, I can see that happening with professors down the road at the university systems.
Jim, thank you for your call. And John, what do you think about those points?
Well, I want to thank Jim for his call. I think there is this concern about public service and viewing agencies and universities and governmental staff as strictly service workers that are meeting particular political needs of the state. I share Jim's concern about the DNR, but I'm not going to go on that topic now. As a hunter and fisherman, I'm a bit concerned about the staff reductions at the DNR, but I assume that the legislature has already considered those matters. On campus, I think this goes back to your earlier question. What are university campuses about? Are they environments where students can come in contact with a whole variety of ideas, some of which will trouble them? They'll be forced to mature, think through challenging ideas, think through challenging texts they have to read, being forced, and I don't mean that in a malicious way, but being a demand being placed on them to examine new ways of thinking. That's what a college educator, that's what I love myself. I love going, I was an undergrad at Minnesota and I was a grad student at Michigan, and I've taught most of my life on this campus. I love big universities because of all the variety of courses. I used to just sit there with a course catalog at the beginning of every semester and I was excited by all kinds of things. I was an economics major, I was a history major, I took courses in comparative lit, I took courses in anthropology, I took courses in the class. I took courses in cinema. It was just this opportunity to know all. I loved it. And when I get those students in my class, they're exciting to have in that room. Now, we could turn it into a technical college and say to those students, sorry, if you're interested in cinema, you'll have to go someplace else. You can't have it at the University of Wisconsin because we're all about jobs. If I may make this personal, my son was a philosophy and art major at the UW. You would think he'd be unemployed now if the governor was right. He's a successful movie scriptwriter in Hollywood, and he's very proud of his Wisconsin education. It's possible, and I might point out that the recently retired baseball commissioner was a history major out of our department. Clearly, you can have a degree in history or philosophy or art, and you can accomplish things in our society that make a fundamental difference to American life.
I want to ask you, given about the diversity of thought and classes and coursework that you just talked about there, I want to read a quote from your piece. You write that, "It's no wonder conservatives in our state legislatures, rightly or wrongly, think our universities, not just Wisconsin, are liberal insane asylums under the control of the inmates." Is that fair?
Is that a great line? I just love that. We went back and forth on that line, and we stuck with it.
Do you stand by it?
We stuck with that line, and I'm stuck with it now. I think what we were saying, we're not arguing that's true. We are arguing that many people in our legislature and elsewhere across the country believe that's true. They believe that on college campuses there's trivial research that wastes valuable dollars, that there's courses being taught that serve no purpose, that liberals dominate the rhetoric and won't allow conservatives to speak up. That's what they believe is the case. And to some extent, universities have done that. It's exaggerated, but you can find examples of each one of those things with sufficient frequency that it confirms the bias of legislators who are on the conservative side of the aisle.
We have another call here. Mike joins us from Franklin. Mike, hi.
I'd like to thank the professor. I personally am a blue-collar worker who has had three children graduate from Madison. But the way I look at this, tenure is a reward for doing a good job. What we want to do is keep the best people here. We don't want them going other places. We want research dollars coming back to Madison, and we want to attract the best people in our state. This for us to do anything else does not make any sense at all to me.
All right. Thank you, Mike. And is Mike, do you agree with Mike has what he has to say, or is it more important to do more job focus?
One of my serious concerns is similar to Mike's. If the word gets out that people's job is not protected here and they may be at risk, we're going to lose very good people. We're going to have trouble recruiting fine people. That's what I'm talking about, damaging the brand. We have already lost a few people who are quite famous. In one case, a chemist went to Minnesota or is going to go to Minnesota. The Center for Discovery is losing its director. This could be a major problem for this campus in recruitment and retainment of famous, important scholars and researchers and teachers.
And as we wrap up, John, on the other hand, you point out that universities haven't always done the best job keeping their own house in order. You've got runaway student debts. You've got runaway tuition. How do universities need to respond to that?
Well, here's the fascinating thing about this is that in the face of that, the legislature has essentially empowered the bureaucracy that caused most of those problems. When the legislature was upset because there was the fund that was held back and they discovered it later, remember that slush fund? The faculty didn't have the slush fund. We had nothing to do with that decision. It was the people in the administration. And what they're doing right now is enhancing the power of university bureaucrats over faculty and students.
John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
That was John Sharpless, history professor at UW-Madison and former Republican congressional candidate.